Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:08 p.m. and it's Wednesday, April 27. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins, my Vice Chair Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Hyman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is Senate Bill 161, Political Party Definition, sponsored by Senator Wilkowski. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is David Dunsmore from Senator Wilkowski's staff. Mr. Dunsmore, if you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilkowski. And Senator Wilkowski sends his regrets that he's double-booked and not able to make it to today's hearing. Senate Bill 161 is a simple bill that was brought to us by an East Anchorage constituent that would simplify the threshold at which political parties gain official recognition by changing it from a threshold that currently varies based on the voter turnout in the top of the ticket election in the most previous general election to just setting a standard of an even 5,000 voters. And in the committee process of the Senate, a population adjustment was added that after every decennial census, that 5,000 number would be adjusted based on population and then rounded to the nearest 500. So there would still be a easy to understand bright line number. Since the current threshold is variable based on voter turnout, it can fluctuate quite wildly. After the high record voter turnout in the previous general election, the threshold increased by 27% to almost 11,000. And setting it at this, in which tying it to voter turnout creates a paradoxical problem where for the lower turnout midterm elections, political parties have to meet a higher threshold that to be on the ballot than for the higher turnout presidential election years. With the passage of ballot measure two, the only offices for which political parties gain automatic ballot access is for president and vice president, but there are still a few other things that are tied to official party status, including the right to buy 2 pages in the official election pamphlet, as well as the right to nominate election workers and have poll watchers, and there are different APOC rules for recognized political parties than for regular groups.
Just as a brief pause, Senator Wilkowski joined us about a minute ago. Welcome, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologize for the delay. We just got off the floor.
We can understand those conflicts, especially in the House. Please proceed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that about concludes the introduction. So if the members have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Question from members. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, through the chair. Just trying to make sure I understand the final sentence in the second paragraph in the sponsor statement. This threshold can vary wildly from election to election. And after the 2020 election, it increased by 27% because of record voter turnout. Can you clarify for me what it means and how that relates to the at least 3% of total votes cast in the preceding sentence?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, in that sentence, it refers to the threshold, the total number of registered voters that a party must have to have official status. And because voter turnout in 2020 was 27% higher than it was in 2018, that's why that number increased by 27%.
So just to clarify the
follow up.
Thank you. Follow up through the chair. So the number of votes required to reach the 3% threshold increased by 27% in the 2020 election.
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, yes, that is correct. And to clarify, prior to ballot measure two, there were two ways a party could achieve official status. They could either have registered voters equal to that 3% number, or their candidate for governor could get 3% of the vote, or not just for governor, but whatever the top of the ticket was in that in the previous election, getting 3%. Prop 2 changed that to now the only way to meet that threshold is through registered voters.
I had a question your office shared with a memo. I'm not sure if it was distributed to the whole committee, raising questions about an amendment we adopted in State Affairs, deleting the words "represents a political program." And I gather that there were some there was more to the picture. If you could talk a little bit about the deletion of that language and whether what your office position is as to whether we should potentially consider undoing that amendment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for raising that issue. Yes, after the bill moved out of the previous committee, the State Affairs Committee chair shared with us a memo they received about the committee substitute. In State Affairs, an amendment was adopted deleting the phrase that a political party shall have a political program. And when we reviewed it at the time, we thought that was kind of just a stylistic change, whether you included it or not, since it seems just kind of definitional if you're seeking official party status, that you would have a political program. But one thing that Ledge Legal pointed out in that memo was that that same having a political program was referenced with regards to political groups. And then most significantly with regards to appointments of people to vacant seats in the legislature, that party status is defined as someone who supports the political program of a party, regardless of whether they changed their voter registration. Seeing as the having a political program seems to be tied to the operation of that statute, which was not our intention to change the statutes for appointment of legislators through this bill, if the committee might want to consider whether it would be wise to revert to the original language that had passed out of the Senate.
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you. Is maybe another way of sort of assessing this political program language, that maintaining that language in this legislation would maintain parallelism in the statutes?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, that is my understanding.
Thank you.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you help me understand, so a political party can be means an organized group of voters, which under this piece of legislation, should it pass, would have at least 5,000 registered voters. How, if the political party doesn't exist before there's 5,000 registered voters, what's the process for those 5,000 voters to indicate that they want to be registered in this heretofore yet uncreated political party? Can you help me understand that process?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, it's spelled out elsewhere in statute, and we can provide that in writing after this hearing. If you're a group that would like to achieve official status, you have to notify the Division of Elections and submit your bylaws, and then they will add you to the voter registration form. And every month, as the Division of Elections updates the voter list, if you hit the threshold, then you become a qualified political party for that election cycle.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions from members of the committee, so I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 161. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear, and it's often difficult to hear what you're saying. First, is there anyone in the room who'd like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 161? Hearing and seeing no one, and looking online in the list of folks that have called in or signed in, I have no one online, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 161. And at this time, we're going to hold the bill for further review. We're going to take about a 2 minute ease to let Representative Tarr know that we're about to start hearing her bill. At ease. Back on record, and Representative Tarr and her staff have joined us. So our second and final order of business today is House Bill 5, Sexual Assault Definition of Consent, sponsored by Representative Tarr. This is the fifth hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee, and we're here to take additional invited testimony. And first, we're joined by Professor Samuel Buell. He's a former federal prosecutor and the Bernard M. Fisher Professor of Law at Duke University. Professor Buell, in significance as it relates to this bill, is he has served for a number of years on the American Law Institute's panel of both academics and practitioners that have been looking at revisions to the model penal code, specifically to provisions about consent and other features of sexual assault in the model penal code. And so we contacted his office also on a somewhat tangential but not specific to this. Duke University Law School has for a long time had a relationship with the state of Alaska as the publishers of the Alaska Law Review. And so he works with students who write articles that relate to Alaska matters. But I've asked Professor Buell to start with some opening comments and then be available for questions from the committee. So Professor Buell, welcome to Juneau. I'm sorry that you're here by Teams and not by... and not here to see our beautiful state, but if you want
to... I can't wait to visit. Is the audio and video acceptable to everyone?
It's good.
Great. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to appear before you to discuss the extremely important issues in criminal law around reforming the definitions of sexual assault and related offenses. And I commend the Alaska legislature in both the House and the Senate for its efforts to make progress on the essential move of shifting focus of the crime of rape from force, which was its historical core, to the more modern concept of consent. As the chairman said, I'm the Bernard M. Fishman Professor at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. I've been a professor since 2004. I teach introductory criminal law and courses relating to corporate and white-collar crime, which is primarily where my scholarship focuses. I'm a graduate of Brown University and NYU School of Law, and prior to entering teaching, I spent 10 years as a prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice in New York, Boston, Washington, and Houston. I am a member of the American Law Institute, and since 2012, I have served as an appointed advisor to the ALI's project to revise the Model Penal Code's treatment of sexual assault and related offenses. My remarks today are based on my own knowledge and views and do not reflect necessarily the positions or opinions of the ALI as a body or of the project's reporters, that is, the individuals who have taken the drafting, laboring oar on this project. There's much that could be discussed about the ALI's MPC reform project, which has been long and labor-intensive over a decade now and has covered many aspects of sex offenses. Today, I just want to say a few words about the two most central issues at the core of defining rape, at least under modern understandings of the nature of the crime. And those are consent and mens rea, or mental state. These two issues have been by far the most central and contentious matters in ALI's debates that have extended over many years now. First, consent. If the basic wrong in sexual assault is, as I think it is, compelling another to submit to sexual penetration or contact without consent, that is, unwanted sex, then one must be very careful to specify what consent is in this context. After all, consent is not an all-purpose concept with one definition in the law. What counts as legally valid or acceptable consent varies depending on the nature of the activity with which the law may be concerned. In the context of sexual offenses, at its core, consent is a question of mental state itself. Was the contact or penetration wanted or unwanted? But the ALI project recognized early on that punishment could not be imposed solely on the basis of an unobservable mental process of one individual. Consent, or the lack thereof, might ultimately be in the mind, but it must be observed or heard or felt in some fashion in order to be known. The ALI settled, after much debate, on a kind of hybrid approach that makes clear that expressed non-consent means no consent. In other words, no means no in the vernacular. But that verbally expressed consent is not required to make sex non-criminal. Consent can also be acted out or performed. And so the current definition in the Model Penal Code draft, which will be before the membership of the ALI at the annual meeting in Washington in just a couple of weeks, is that consent means a person's willingness to engage in a specific act of sexual penetration, oral sex, or sexual contact, all of which are defined terms. And then it goes on to say, neither verbal nor physical resistance is required to establish that consent is lacking. Consent may be expressed, or it may be inferred from behavior, both action and inaction, in the context of all the circumstances, making the question of consent a very much a variable and fact-based question. This language, to be clear, is a compromise. Some wanted an affirmative yes requirement. That is, that consent would only exist when there was an affirmative verbal yes or something equivalent. But many pushed back, saying that this would require changes in existing sexual norms and practices that would place the ALI too far ahead of the social curve in the law reform process. The current definition was seen as accommodating the rights of both victims and accused persons and of being realistic with respect to the Institute's best effort to understand the current situation nationally of sexual mores. House Bill 5, and thank you for sharing it with me, appears to be headed in a similar direction. However, I would think carefully about whether the current language should be simplified to avoid confusion in application and interpretation in the judicial process. The general definition in Section 6 of the bill is fine as far as it goes, though it leaves some question about what it means to, quote, freely enter into an agreement. Similarly, the current Senate bill in Alaska, which you shared with me, uses the somewhat fraught term, quote, free will. Section 5 of the House bill is somewhat more problematic in my view, as it attempts to specify further some conditions under which consent is lacking, which may raise further questions, particularly the idea in subsection C3 that lack of resistance would be caused by, quote, unquote, the offender's actions. And I'm not sure what that causation inquiry with respect to lack of resistance is meant to cover. Consider, for example, the case that was often discussed in our ALI deliberations of the frozen fear victim or the motionless victim. Ultimately, there is no avoiding the difficulty in the drafting process that the law must make judgments about what kinds of pressure render consent invalid. And there's no disputing that society in general views many forms of sex in situations of lesser power imbalances to be outside the proper scope of the criminal law. Thus, the problem with simply saying, quote, freely given, unquote, or quote, free will, unquote, which tend to beg the question of what level of free decision making really specifies the line between legally operative consent and failure of consent. Second, a few words about mens rea. I take it that Alaska's general MPC style rules on statutory construction would require a finding of recklessness as to lack of consent for conviction. That is, that the offender must be reckless as to the lack of consent. This is consistent with where the ALI has landed after some discussion, which was then rejected, about the possibility of negligence liability for the lowest level of offense. I wonder whether it might make sense to use the term recklessly within the crime definitions themselves, not simply to rely on the general Alaska statutory provision on mens rea. And the reason I say this is because your statutory provision on mens rea requires a mental state of knowingly for any conduct elements and specifies recklessness for circumstances or results. This could lead to debates about what parts of the sexual assault definitions are actually part of the conduct element of the offenses, as opposed to aspects of a circumstance or a result. And you might avoid confusion and possibly litigation over that issue by being more specific with the mens rea in the definitions themselves. In any event, it is important to convey in the context of your debates and deliberations, that recklessness is in fact a highly culpable knowledge state. It means, under the Alaska and MPC definitions, knowledge of risk. That is, the actor must have contemplated the question of whether consent was lacking, perceived that there was some risk that it was, and decided to proceed nonetheless. It is not a form of, for example, aggravated negligence. It has taken much work, even within the ALI, to persuade non-criminal lawyers of this reality. There was a great deal of discussion about how if a recklessness mens rea was used, it might lead to convictions of mistaken actors, for example. And that is not the case under the MPC-style definition of recklessness, and we had many debates about whether juries can be counted on to follow jury instructions. Two other quick comments on your current draft, and then I'll stop. First, there has been extensive debate within the ALI about grading and punishment and the desire not to contribute to excessive incarceration through this project. The ALI draft is probably a bit at odds with House Bill 5, which treats, as I read it, penetration without consent alone as a first-degree felony, even in the absence of, for example, the use of force. While definitely the definition of the core offense here should move away from a requirement that force be used. There's a long history of why that's made rape law problematic for victims. Force does have usefulness in being retained as an aggravating factor, particularly certain kinds of force. And so I would suggest maybe some further consideration of grading distinctions between a non-consensual sex with the requisite culpability and non-consensual sex that's procured through the use of physical force. And the ALI draft, which is available for everyone to look at online, can give you some sense of what the choices are that the ALI has made in terms of grading the different levels of sexual assault. Second and lastly, I was quite confused by the language in Section 1A5 of the bill, House Bill 5, about artifice, pretense, and concealment. I don't think it's clear enough to the reader, which cases of so-called rape by fraud, which I take it is what you're in some sense after there, you are actually seeking to cover with that language. And one of the very tricky issues in rape law reform is determining what kinds of deception are going to render consent invalid such that a subsequent sex becomes criminal because, of course, the deception comes in so many different forms and contexts, and many of those have traditionally and even under sexual assault reform efforts not been treated as a sufficient basis for imprisonment. Thank you, and I look forward to discussing this with you.
Questions from members of the committee? Representative Snyder.
Thank you. Through the chair, taking this all in, I apologize. I'm going to ask you to repeat yourself a little bit on the issue of recklessness, if you could. Could you return to that topic and revisit?
Sure. Let me just actually quote the Alaska. This is existing Alaska criminal law, Alaska statutes, section 11.81.900. which defines the various mental states that are part of Alaska's criminal code, which was modeled after the MPC. So this is a model penal code approach. And what that section of Alaska law says is that a person acts recklessly with respect to a result or to a circumstance described by a provision of law defining an offense when the person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. And there's a little bit more to the definition, but that's the central part, right? So in order to understand what that means, you have to understand the criminal law lingo, what we mean when we talk about in elements of crimes, results and circumstances. So a result would be the causation of death in a homicide statute. Prosecutor must prove among the elements of homicide that the defendant caused the death of a human being. That's something we call that a result because that's something that happened as a consequence of the defendant's physical conduct that is a separate element that must be proven, right? If there's no death of a human being, then you might have an attempted murder case, but you would not have a murder or manslaughter case. When we use the term circumstance to describe an element of a crime, we mean something about the world that's separate and apart from what the defendant did or what the defendant was thinking that must have been true for the defendant's conduct to be criminal. The prosecutor must prove that circumstance existed. So a really simple example would be the age of a victim in a case in which a victim's age is relevant. It doesn't have to be a sex offense. There are many crimes that have to do with victim age or victim status. So that would be a circumstance, right? So then for the definition of the mens rea, the mental state, to say, well, you have to be reckless as to a result or a circumstance, that means the defendant, let's say that the statute is, you know, you can't sell cigarettes to somebody under 18 years old, and there's a criminal penalty for that. The defendant must have been reckless to be, the cigarette seller must have been reckless to violate that statute as to the fact that the purchaser victim was under 18. That means that he or she must have, again, to use this language, been aware of and consciously disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that that circumstance existed. That is, that the victim was less than 18. So thought about it and decided to go ahead and sell the cigarettes anyway. Gee, she looks 18. I don't know if she is, but I'm not going to ask for an ID or check. I'm going to go ahead and sell the cigarettes anyway. Now, the reason why the recklessness definition uses the term unjustifiable risk is because, particularly in the reckless driving context, for example, you might have situations where somebody substantially risks something, but has a good justification for doing so. You know, I had a person in my car who was bleeding to death and I needed to get them to the emergency room, so I drove maybe not totally safely. And that would allow the jury to consider that. In the sexual offenses context, and we've had some discussion about this in the ALI, it's not clear whether that word unjustifiable would really be doing any work. I mean, when would it be considered by a jury to be justified for somebody to have taken the risk that a victim might not be consenting when it's so easy simply to communicate about the matter? So what I'm really focusing on isn't so much the justifiability of the risk here as the fact that the definition says the actor must have been aware of the risk. And that is a knowledge state. That's not like negligence. It's not, you know, you didn't think about it. It's you thought about it. You were aware of it. And you decided to proceed in the face of the risk.
And just as a add on, in the statute that talks about mental states specific to sexual assault in the first degree, another provision of that same section says it's knowing as to conduct and reckless as to circumstance. And so placed in the specific context of a sexual assault, you would say, was it knowing as to the conduct of sexual penetration and then reckless right. as to the circumstance of lack of consent? And if I got that wrong, he'll get me straightened out.
You know, just to get the other side of the argument as it played out in the ALI, I mean, for the people who are pushing in favor of a recklessness standard, because some people said, look, it should be knowledge. Nobody should go to prison unless they're practically certain, which is the knowledge definition, that consent is lacking. And, of course, the answer to that was that makes the bar extremely high for conviction, because since the prosecutor has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, the raising a doubt about whether one was or wasn't completely sure that consent was lacking would be enough to produce an acquittal.
I had a question. You made reference to Section 6 of House Bill 5 on the consent definition about means freely given reversible agreement. Has the model penal code, the MPC as you often refer to it, taken a different approach to that consent definition? And can you provide some feedback about the pros and cons of this approach that's in House Bill 5 and how the model penal code has approached that same concept?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, this is a really difficult. I mean, this is the absolute nub of this law reform problem. And I can't tell you how many hours were spent debating this within the ALI at different drafts that, you know, the reporters went through. I think that the ALI chose not to use a word like freely or free will because the belief was that, you know, it raises, it simply begs the question of what kind of freedom of thought you need in order to be a person who is genuinely consenting. So what did we end up with in the ALI definition? We ended up with the word willingness, right? Consent means a person's willingness to engage in a specific act of sexual penetration, oral sex, or sexual contact. And I think the idea there in using willingness was to try to capture more of a concept that this is something that's actually wanted, not something that's simply agreed to. And then the question is, well, how free was that agreement, right? Willingness, it seems to me, and now we're getting into sort of, you know, distinctions in dictionary definitions and synonyms and so forth. But I mean, it seemed to me that willingness set a little bit of a higher bar for where the victim's state of mind needs to be for there to be consent. And perhaps is less question begging than the idea of freely given or free will, which raises the question of, well, what's freedom in this context? But I'm not going to say that there's a perfect solution here. I'm not going to say that there wouldn't be in states that chose to adopt the new MPC provisions. I'm not going to say there won't be debates about what constitutes willingness. And, you know, if I were a judge handling the ALI's proposed statute, I probably would just instruct a jury with willingness. I'd be reluctant to want to try to define that further. And so it becomes one of those issues that you sort of are going to rely on juries to resolve. And the words you choose might push things a little bit one way or another, but they're not going to completely eliminate the problem.
So let me follow up on that a little more to make sure I'm following your response. If we are to look at this from a prosecution perspective, and particularly with respect then to the victim's perspective on what is consent, are you suggesting that the use of the willingness approach that's in the model penal code proposal is more victim friendly than the freely given approach that's in House Bill 5?
That's my instinct, right? But part of the reason that I'm saying that,
kind of flesh that out.
Well, because again, to me, the word, the idea of freely given, well, okay, you gave agreement. You gave facial consent, or whatever we want to call it. Then we said, well, was it freely given? Right? Well, that depends on what the circumstances under which, you know, consent was given were. Right? Whereas willingness seems to go more to the ultimate question of the internal mental state of the victim. Did the victim actually want this sexual penetration or contact or not? So I do, that is my instinct, but you know, this isn't this is new law, new model law that hasn't even been completed by the ALI, much less adopted by any state. So there's no case law. There's no litigation or trial experience around these definitions. And so, the question always becomes, and certainly for prosecutors and defense lawyers, how's this actually going to play out in court cases? And you'd have to see it play out, for a while, before you'd have, a really good sense. So I don't think there's an easy answer here, but I'm just flagging for you that this idea of sort of what is freely given consent or what is free will, does leave unresolved a little bit the ultimate question here, which is what kinds of pressures on people make their decisions not free? A classic example that's often used in discussions around this is, suppose you have a woman who's, in a domestic, bad domestic situation with a, violent domestic relationship, but there is a huge economic disparity in the relationship, right? And she's completely dependent on a man, let's say, for housing and food and such. And he says, look, if you don't stop withholding sex from me, you're not going to have a roof over your head anymore. And I have no doubt that there are situations like that that do occur in this world. Are those cases rape? Is that freely given consent? That's a really hard question, right? I think clearly those cases are not generally prosecuted. And the idea is kind of like, well, lots of people are unhappy with their situations. That doesn't make the relationship you're in one in which rape is occurring on a daily basis. Now, many theorists would say, well, the law's got that wrong. But it's a real question as to whether the law wants to get involved in that kind of thing. So, I understand that I'm more like issue spotting here for you than I am resolving the issues. But I just, want to stress both how difficult these questions are, how important they are, but also the fact that, you have to get the best language you can. And, you're the legislators. You know this more than I do, I'm sure. You can't, draft a language that's going to necessarily resolve all these problems.
So at least in terms of the consent definition, what we have in Senate Bill 9, if we were inclined to try a more model penal code approach, we would use the consent that references willingness rather to freely given. And at least in your perspective, that may be actually more victim friendly than the freely given approach.
I think so. That was certainly the intent behind the choice of that language in the ALI process. And then, the model penal code definition as it currently exists goes on to, follow basically the path that you've got in your bill of further specifying. And I think it's important to do this to say that, look, consent can be expressed, but it can also be inferred from the circumstances. And that was, in other words, that willingness, to use the word that defines consent, willingness can be inferred from the circumstances. And that was a very important issue for a large part of the body of the Institute, who felt that we had to recognize the fact that there are many situations in which sexual contact and sexual penetration occurs through kind of mutual physical action, unaccompanied by words or discussion, but that is fully consensual. And we had to be really careful not to criminalize that.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And Mr. Buell, forgive me on the pronunciation if I got it wrong, on the rape by artifice and fraud piece, could you just restate your summary your analysis of that proposed language and also the extent to which.
Let me just look at this again. Okay, so this is section, it appears in a couple of places, but I'm looking at section 1A5, page 2 of the bill. And it's basically saying that this is a, this would be sexual assault in the first degree. The offender engages in sexual penetration with the person whom the offender has induced to believe by artifice, pretense, or concealment that the offender is another person based on the offender's real identity, not on characteristics, traits, or accomplishments of or similar facts about the offender, with reckless disregard that the person would not have consented. That's the mens rea part. I take it that what the drafters are trying to get at here is the what has traditionally been treated by criminal law, even under the older law of rape in many, many jurisdictions, as sexual assault, which is the case of basically impersonation. So an example that's often used is, and there actually have been a few of these cases, identical twins. So twin A is in a relationship with a woman, and twin B has sex with that woman. She thinks it's twin A who's having sex with her. She finds out later it wasn't. It was twin B. She's had sex with a human being who was literally not the person she thought she was having sex with. That has commonly been treated, as I think it should be, as rape. The problem is, how do you write a definition that distinguishes that case from, the guy who gets paid to go to birthday parties and be the Johnny Depp impersonator? Let's not maybe take something that's too ripped from the headlines this week, but this person is sort of an actor or whatever, and they try, hey, you look kind of like Johnny Depp. Well, I actually am Johnny Depp. And sort of tricks the woman into wanting to sleep with him. Those cases, are awfully close to the, hey, I'm a really rich guy who owns a hedge fund, when, the guy actually works at a convenience store, or, these kind of lying deception cases that are morally problematic, but have traditionally not been treated as a criminal because of a fear of sort of how do you draw the lines, and it's a slippery slope, what kinds of, so people are, if you don't tell 100% the truth in all your relationships, you're engaging in sexual assault. I mean, nobody wants that to be the law. I just find the language here difficult to understand when I've just never seen it defined that way. Another person based on the offender's real identity. I don't understand what that means.
Representative Christ Tompkins, follow up.
Thank you. Is there language from other states that you're familiar with that speak to these situations that are?
Undoubtedly there is. I don't have it in front of me. This isn't an issue on which I've written a law review article, for example, or done my own research. My only familiarity with it is teaching it in first year criminal law and the material that's in the case books about it, where they'll use an example, sometimes the statute or a case. But I don't think your staff would have any trouble at all doing some research on this. And I believe there's an academic literature on this. So if you did some searches in the law review database on Westlaw, you'd probably come up with a couple of good law review pieces that would have all the citations you needed in the footnotes to find some examples of statutes and so forth. So I just, when I first read this, I wasn't clear whether you were trying to limit this to the traditional category of deception cases that have been treated as rape, or there was some intent here perhaps to try to broaden that concept to have liability for some other things that had not usually been covered in terms of what kinds of lies and deceptions to procure sex would be treated as negating consent.
Kind of following up on Representative Christ Tompkins' question, does the model penal code draft the most current version of the model penal code draft, does that in address the impersonation topic? And if so,
it does.
Which section?
Take me just a minute to get it. Hang on a second. I've got it here on my machine.
A comment, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I mean, just as the model penal code citation is looked up. I mean, I remember having some confusion and concern about the sort of the extent to which this language is tailored to the some of the situations that were just described by the testifier. And, you know, undoubtedly, we want to sort of speak to those situations. It's just the sort of tightness in statutory language that I think is my interest here.
Yeah. Hang on here. I'm almost there. It's a very long draft because we dealt with, you know, registration, child offenses, sex trafficking, all kinds of things. So it takes a minute to find the...
Is it 213.5, sexual assault by prohibited deception?
That's probably it. Yeah, 213.5. Let me just get there, and then I can confirm for you that that's the equivalent provision. I'm there now. Yes. So 213.5. So B1B1 is the category of cases that you also cover somewhere in your bill, which have also traditionally been part of this, which is the fake medical procedure kind of scam. There are a number of those cases, particularly out of California, that were established long ago to be rape. And then 1B2 caused the person to believe falsely that the actor was someone else who was personally known to that person. And that deception causes the person to engage in. So in the current MPC draft, it's really limited to that, aside from the medical cases, which are a different category, the treatment cases. It's limited to, you know, I'm trying to think of how to describe, you know, you're literally impersonating someone, and that someone is known to the victim. Right. So I suppose the guy walking across the crowded room at a conference and going, "Hey, I'm Bill Clinton," you know, would not be covered. But "Hey, remember me? I'm that guy you went home from the bar with last week." And it's really the speaker's friend. And there's a deception there to try to get the victim to believe, like, "Oh, this is someone that I have already slept with," or "this is my partner," or something like that. That's a pretty narrow category. And I think the reason why the criminal law has kept it that way is the fear of, if you open it up to other kinds of deception, where do you draw the line?
So on that topic, one of the comments, I'm not sure if it's a critique or not, but one of the comments I'd heard about the language in subsection 5 you're talking about is it's both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. It provides a certain degree of specificity as to certain conduct, but by providing that specificity, it almost by having that specificity then excludes other conduct that one might otherwise want to be criminal. Is that a...
I don't know what that would be. I'd need to hear more about that. I'd need to hear what an example would be of a case you'd want to cover that's not covered by this language.
Okay. Do you have a question, Representative Snyder?
I do, Mr. Chair, but it zooms out or goes in a slightly different direction.
I think Representative Christ Tompkins had done with follow-ups on this, so you're good to go.
Okay, thank you. Backing up a little bit, can you help me understand better the process and those involved in the conversations had and the input considered in developing these updates to the model penal code?
Yeah, sure. I'll try to be brief because it's a decade-long process. But you may know, and I actually didn't have a chance to look at existing Alaska law before the hearing today, which we just talked about doing a couple days ago. So I don't know whether Alaska adopted the original MPC or model penal code provisions on sex offenses that were drafted in the 1950s and completed in the early 1960s. So I don't know whether or not you're familiar with the fact
just to those. Just as a short aside, just so the discussions. Yeah. Alaska made a major revision to its penal code in the late 1970s. I'm actually not sure whether it was fully adopted in 1978 or 1980, but it was largely following the model penal code. So Alaska, of course, no one completely adopts it exactly, but largely we adopted the model penal code in essentially the end of the 1970s, about 1980. There's a criminal code review manual that they published that was a loose leaf notebook at the time that went through a lot of the details, and there's a few of those circulating around, including in my office. But we essentially took on the model penal code in 1980, and we've made changes in different ways since that time.
Right. So, I mean, the model penal code as a whole is a huge success story in the history of the criminal law, I think, and certainly the American Law Institute, one of the most influential products, maybe next to the Uniform Commercial Code, that the ALI has been involved in over the years, did a lot to clarify and make more rigorous American criminal law. But at the time they were drafting, and it was a small group of people then, and basically a collection of sort of older white male law professors, not a very representative group. The whole movement to kind of think about rape law from the perspective of victims' rights and to think about the problem sociologically and what was really going on out there was still a decade away from even starting. So the provisions they came up with were not going to stand the test of time. They were based on force, not consent. They had some very wrong turns in them, like an exception for spousal rape and that kind of thing. So the ALI had been talking for decades about, not decades, but, for maybe 20 years, about doing something about this. And the head of the ALI about 10 years ago, who's now retired, said, okay, let's do it. Let's have this revision project. So first thing you do is you appoint the reporters. They're the people who are going to do the writing. And he appointed Stephen Schulhofer, a professor of law at NYU, who'd written a very influential book about rape law reform called Unwanted Sex. And then a number of us were appointed to be advisors to the project, and we started having informal meetings just to kind of brainstorm, where we would go. And then this work is extremely painstaking. I mean, if you read the drafts, they're not just the black letter law, they're all the background materials and the research that goes into that. It's an incredible resource, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's working on your law revision to spend some time with. And so maybe 2 years later, a first draft came out, and then it just starts going through revisions. And basically what happened over time was the more this was revised and the more discussions there were, and then it started coming up at the annual meetings in May, which are usually in New York or San Francisco. And we sort of did provisions at a time. I think we had a whole meeting that was just on the consent definition. More and more people became aware that the ALI was doing this, and people perceived the ALI to be an influential organization. So I would say that the circle expanded very quickly over time. And by the time we got to 3, 4, 5 years ago, I mean, you basically had everybody in these discussions. State judges, federal judges, defense attorneys, prosecutors, victims' rights organizations, lawyers who are very thoughtful members of the ALI who aren't even experts in this field, many law professors, it's a little bit of a kind of hodgepodge, because you don't systematically say, like, okay, we need one of this from each state and one of those from each state. You have a prosecutor from Wisconsin State Court over here, and federal judge from Texas, and a victims' rights person from Philly, it's just a deliberative process over time. And I think that what ended up happening as a result is that we got something that was moderate kind of moves the ball forward, but tries to take into account some really deep concerns that were raised by mostly defense lawyers, some academics, some others, some judges, about being careful not to make the law go too far, and to be concerned not just with the rights of victims, but also with the ability of accused persons to get fair trial in this context and to have the issues fairly litigated, and that mistaken actors not be convicted. Also, many people in the conversation along the way are pushing back on the question of further criminalization. Why is the ALI involved in a project that's going to put more people in prison at the very time when we should be finding ways to reduce the levels of incarceration? And then, of course, a lot of the reform and victims advocates pushing back and saying, but rape is the one crime that has been most egregiously under-enforced in our criminal justice system. And so this really isn't about mass incarceration. So a lot of debates on several different dimensions. I think it's the view of the Institute, although I'm not here to express the Institute's views, that the current draft is a balance of interests and that that's the way it kind of should be. And that's the way the ALI is supposed to operate, that it's not an advocacy organization for one particular view of a legal issue or another, but it represents the kind of collective wisdom of the legal profession. And the ALI has been pretty successful with that over the years. I don't know about this project because it's such a contentious issue and we're in a very different political environment than we were when the ALI did the restatement of torts and contracts and the UCC and the original model penal code. But I think it's, you know, it's a pretty impressive work product, even if you don't end up agreeing with all the decisions that were made in terms of the statutory language. The volumes of work that have been done to explain what the law is. I mean, on almost any issue in this draft, you can pick up the full booklet and you can read a long discussion, which will give you a summary of what every single state has done on that issue. So I can't think of a better resource if you were sort of looking for a menu of possibilities.
Follow up on a broad question. Representative Christ Thompson.
So process-wise, thank you, Mr. Chair. Process-wise, this was initiated 10 years ago, and through the what you just described, the end product has just been relatively recently produced by ALI, and now we're sort of at the forefront of prospective adoption by states.
Well, the membership approved in large part the biggest chunks of this at the last meeting that occurred right before COVID. There was no annual meeting in 2020. There was an online annual meeting in 2021 where big parts of this were approved. The consent thing was approved several years ago. That kind of came first because everyone looked at that as sort of the central issue and a piece that we could just focus on that one thing and try to get something approved. Now all these other things, most of them have been approved at the 2021 remote meeting. The draft went back to what's called the ALI Council, which is kind of the executive committee of the ALI, for a further look. They're not supposed to, at that point, kind of override what the membership has decided, but they can identify errors and issues that need further clarification. And so tentative draft 6, which is just ALI lingo, is the most current draft. That includes some tweaks and revisions. For example, at the annual meeting in 21, the definition of consent was approved to include some language about resistance may be considered, even though it's not required to show non-consent. And there was some further discussion since then, decision to take that language out so that we didn't even have anything in there that even suggested that resistance was still a relevant element. So to the extent that the ALI Council has made tweaks in the last year, and they've made some tweaks, partly, by the way, in response to some pushback from victims' rights groups on a few issues, particularly in the sex trafficking area of the draft. It's now coming back to the members in a couple of weeks at the annual meeting in Washington to vote on those tweaks. And I think once those have been voted on, that should pretty much be it. There'll be some sort of, just like there is with legislation, some sort of massaging of editorial issues subsequent to that, But nobody needs to wait for the ALI to finish to use their product. I mean, you could use any of it you wanted now. It doesn't have the force of law. It will simply be published by the ALI and it'll essentially be out there for legislatures that are interested in using it. I don't think the ALI really goes around pushing its products to legislatures. It more just kind of makes them available. And if people want to use them, great. That's what we hope. That's what they're there for. And obviously people who've been involved in the project like me are available to help talk to folks about it at any time.
Just to follow up on that same topic, it's my understanding that not a majority of the states, but there have been some states that have been taking up changes to sexual assault laws. And
oh, yeah.
You see different parts of the ALI approach appearing in, I would say, almost all those. It shows up in different ways, but not always the same way. And it's not always not a complete adoption of the ALI approach, but not a complete rejection either. And if I've got that wrong, he can correct me, but I think that's right. States are studying in the process. Representative Snyder.
The reform, I mean, it's the ALI's expectation. The idea of a model code is that it's a model, not that it gets adopted the way like the Uniform Commercial Code has by most states, or the way the Federal Rules of Evidence has been adopted as state evidence law in many, many places. It's more, this is a model code. It's a place to start basing a reform project around. And there's every expectation that these are difficult issues, as we've discussed today. They're controversial. There's every expectation that states will go in a variety of different directions on this. And so that's not any, you know, that's not any sort of disappointment for the ALI at all.
Representative Snyder. I know we've got a little while. I know we've got a couple more invited testimony today, so we can't use up all our time with Professor Buell.
It'll be my last one, Mr. Chair.
You can probably have two if you want.
Continuing that thread about states making modifications to the model that is put forward by ALI, I'd love to hear you speak a little bit to what drives those modifications in this context, specifically with sexual assault. Is it typically primarily political or cultural or hot button issues around social challenges? In your experience, what drives those changes, and when are those changes, in your view, well justified? What factors?
Yeah, I know that's a really hard question for me to answer, because I haven't. I wish Erin Murphy were here. She's one of the reporters on the project who's probably done the most heavy lifting in terms of following what's going on in all of the states and what has gone on up until this project. And naturally, she's following what's happening on a forward-looking basis. Unfortunately, Erin, who's a professor at NYU Law School, is on leave right now because she took a job at the White House to be a domestic policy advisor on criminal law issues for them. So she's not able to talk, you know, about the project at this time, although she will be in the future. She's just on leave. She'll be back at NYU, and this will always be partly her work, and I'm sure she'll be available. So I'm just like not, you know, I just don't have enough data to really answer that question. I will say that in a broader sense, a dynamic that is often present in criminal law reform debates at both the state and federal level, and I would expect it to be just as present in debates in this area, is the voice of prosecutors, which often is very influential, saying, don't, you know, narrow the law at all, because you're going to make it harder for us to get convictions. You know, there are proposals, there have been proposals out there for even broader definitions around issues of consent and mens rea than are in the ALI draft, which is viewed as a reform project that broadens the law from where it was half a century ago. But there are proposals that, you know, and there were discussions in the ALI context that doesn't go far enough. There should have been negligence liability, or consent should be lacking unless you have a verbal yes. So I would expect there's some of that in discussions in other jurisdictions, and prosecutors will often say, look, we think this broader definition is necessary for us to be able to defeat this argument or that argument that we frequently get in court. And then somebody will say, yeah, but under your broader definition, let me show you how it actually covers a case that you wouldn't want to have, that nobody thinks is sufficiently culpable that person deserves to go to prison. And then the answer is, well, oh, don't worry, we use our discretion. We don't bring those cases. And so I would, it wouldn't surprise me if in jurisdictions that are pushing very hard in the victim's rights direction on this, that if you didn't get the right kind of discussion, the right kind of pushback, you might end up with definitions that are overbroad. And then I suppose there are, contingents pushing back the other way. I mean, in the ALI, it was really the large body of experienced criminal defense lawyers who were pushing back on, these definitions need to be specific and they need to be narrow and people have to be able to get a fair trial. Those folks, I don't know what it's like in Alaska, but there are many jurisdictions where those folks don't have a lot of voice in the legislative process. So it may depend a little bit, as you say, on politics and sort of who gets heard, in the process, and also how much the process listens to and defers to experts. And I suppose that varies a great deal from state house to state house.
One last area I wanted to ask about. You had made some comments about how in House Bill 5, there's no distinction between use of force, sex assault where the use of force is involved and sex assault where it's not involved, and it's simply a question of consent, not to suggest that's a simple topic. And then in the Senate bill that you looked at, Senate Bill 187, it does make that distinction between use of force for first degree and not use of force for second degree. Can you, from what you've seen in terms of how other states have approached, because I've certainly heard the comment about the use of force is irrelevant. It's just as much a violation without force as with force. What have you seen other states do with respect to that question in terms of distinguish between where force is involved and where it's not involved?
Yeah, again, I'm not, I don't have the data at my fingertips. Very hard to generalize here, but my sense is that the prevailing approach would be to grade for states that do have an offense that's based on non-consensual sex, to grade that at a lower level than an offense that uses force, with force defined in some significant way, right? Because the problem with force as an element under old rape law was often it wasn't defined. And then you'd have the question of, well, is the physical pressure of one body on another that's involved in sexual penetration itself force, such that you always have force, kind of thing. So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a force definition that talks about, threats of violence, the use of a weapon, threatened use of a weapon or display of a weapon or actual use of a weapon, elements that have to do with injury to the victim. I mean, these are things that I think within the ALI discussion, most people agreed were substantially aggravating factors. And that's not to minimize the basic offense, but to say that there are, there are distinctions to be made. The sort of first, second degree thing doesn't really do much for those of us who aren't enmeshed in a particular jurisdiction's law, because it all depends on how does that jurisdiction treat a first degree felony or a second degree felony. What is the difference? What are the penalties?
But your essential point being that.
But the issue is to just say, look, a criminal code should be proportional in the kinds of penalties that it imposes, even within particular kinds of crimes. More serious, more harmful, more damaging forms of that crime should be punished more, and the higher sentences should be reserved for those cases, not put all of them at the highest level.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. I really want to thank you for taking the time to come all the way from North Carolina and visit with us today. And appreciate you taking the time and your remarks. Next, we have...
Thank you. I'm going to step out if that's okay.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's dinner hour where you are.
Yep.
Next, we're joined. We've got actually two folks from the University of Alaska Justice Center. First, we've heard earlier from Dr. Troy Payne, director of the Alaska Justice Information Center and assistant professor in the Justice Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He's with us on Teams. I had asked Dr. Payne after his last presentation when he talked about the sex assault statistics from 2013 with the new definition going forward. I'd asked him to actually get what data he could find with the old definition, because the question that had struck me and I wanted Dr. Payne to talk about was, over the times we've been collecting these statistics, has it gotten better in Alaska, or have we been struggling with kind of these same statistics over a long time? And so welcome back, Dr. Payne. If you want to identify yourself quickly, you can proceed with your presentation, and then I'm sure we'll have some questions. Oh, and Representative Eastman joined us at 2:20. Dr. Payne, can you hear us okay?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. So I am Troy Payne. I'm director of the Alaska Justice Information Center, and I am an associate professor of justice at the UAA Justice Center. I've presented to this committee recently UCR rape statistics from 2013 through the most currently available information. And as the chairman said, there was a question about that going back even further. So in my presentation, if we can be on slide 2, please. I don't really need to get into specifics of this definition, because I'm not convinced that it matters that much in this context. But the reason that the definition for rape in the FBI's Uniform Crime Report Statistics changed in 2013 is that that definition that was used up until then was the carnal knowledge of a female forcibly and against her will. And the rest of the definitions are just defining the terms that are used in that definition. So the carnal knowledge of a female forcibly against her will, where carnal knowledge was defined as sexual intercourse or the slightest penetration of a female sex organ by a male sex organ. And quite correctly, for years, there have been a number of advocates and academics saying that UCR's definition of rape does not encompass a wide variety of acts that many of us would consider sexual assault in common language, and that many state statutes considered sexual assault. And so that's why the definition changed in 2013. What we're interested in today, though, is not this difference in definitions, but just overall trends in the state of Alaska. So if we can go to the next slide, please, slide 3. So slide 3 shows the Alaska rape rate per 100,000 population using this definition, this legacy definition, this old definition, going all the way back to 1979. That extends through to 2016 because there was some overlap. There were a few years where both definitions were reported by the UCR. The big thing to get from this slide and this chart is that for every year that we have readily accessible data, the Alaska rates for rape were higher than national averages. So the same sorts of patterns that we saw the last time that I was presenting to this committee hold for data going all the way back to 1979. Other questions about that?
Questions for Dr. Payne?
No questions? Okay. So if we can move on to slide 4. Now, at this point, I have to admit that I'm not an expert on criminal sentencing generally, nor am I an expert on changes to Alaska law. So I was using a brief review of changes to the statute that was provided by the chair's office.
That's a recent number that you all should have received in the packet, a list of changes to sex assault laws and specifically sentencing provisions that we distributed to the committee.
Correct. And there are details in that brief that are not on this chart, but the years in which the changes were enacted are marked here, so you can cross-reference this against the slightly more detailed research report that you have. What we see when looking at the rape rates and looking at changes in the statute, that there appears to be little difference in aggregate rates over time, regardless of changes in the statute. The pattern that we see for rape rates is really one of those rates kind of oscillating around their average across the entire time series. So they go up a bit, they go down a bit, but there's not a clear and consistent pattern that holds for a number of years. So seeing this display and seeing where there had been changes in the criminal penalties might be useful to the committee. Again, there's a variety of details and complications in criminal sentencing that aren't listed on this chart, and you can see the legislative history research for that.
Any questions on this slide? Doesn't look like it. Oh, Representative Eastman.
Okay, no, I got the answer. Thank you.
Okay. I think that's the last slide we've got from Dr. Payne.
That is all that I have. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Christ Tompkins has a question.
I mean, this is partly in response to my question in a previous hearing about, okay, if we jack up sentences on crimes, does it actually reduce what we're trying to prevent? And the sentences on sex assault crimes have been, extraordinarily ratcheted up over the previous decades, and the rate of rape has not changed. Is that a fair conclusion?
Through the chair, yes. That there have been changes in sentence lengths, and in particular, the presumptive sentence lengths, is my understanding, is that that's where there have been dramatic changes over time. We have not seen dramatic changes in offense rates over time. So that would be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Just a little bit of confusion on my part on the slide. So I see in 2003, we increased the max to 40 years. But then it seems to say in 2006, we increased the max to 40 years again. I just wondered if you could clarify that.
I did that very quickly this morning, and the clarification may be an error, maybe just a simple error on my part. Let me check. Yes. So the as far as I can tell from the legislative research summary of changes, there was not a change in the maximum sentence from 2003 to 2006. I believe the change was in the presumptive range.
Thank you.
And I think specifically the change was in the minimum. The minimum went up, I think, between those times. Representative Christ Thompson.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then I realize this might be out of the scope of your working knowledge, Mr. Payne, but there's question of deterrence, which my understanding is that a lot of the research and data in criminal justice is deterrence does not necessarily have a profound effect in actually deterring crimes. But then there is sort of another thought that sexual predators or a subset of people who commit sexual crimes are irredeemable or not capable of reform or rehabilitation. And so the only place for them to belong is locked away, basically. And if they're in jail, they aren't going to be able to commit more sex crimes, at least the general population. I suppose within our institutions, there's a whole another problem, but that's not really in scope here. And so I'm curious in terms of recidivism and reoffense of people who've committed sex crimes once released, because even with these presumptive ranges, you know, in the decades, I mean, they're still coming back into society. They might be more geriatric than they were when they first entered our correctional system. But is there, what's the data on reoffense and
recidivism? Representative, you're ahead of the curve, because our next guest is Dr. Brad Mercel, who actually has done research and has a report and has done a report, I think, in the mid 2015, 2016, some of which is incorporated in the 2019 sex offense report from the Criminal Justice Commission. He's our next guest.
Great. Mr. Payne, spare you the question and save that for the next.
Through the chair, I can answer the question on deterrence generally. And that's that in general, increasing criminal sanctions for offenses has not been shown through decades of research to impact offender behavior. So it is possible to deter offenders through a variety of other things, mostly involving the immediate situation. But increasing the criminal sanction for acts is unlikely to deter offenders.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Payne? I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for coming again and sharing your remarks with the committee. And last day, we're joined by Dr. Brad Mercel, director of the UAA Justice Center and professor in the Justice Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He's also with us on Teams. If you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Sure. Thank you. Before I get started, I'll just do the obligatory quick mic check.
Coming through loud and clear.
All right. Well, good afternoon, Chair Clayman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Brad Mercel. As Chair Clayman mentioned, I am the director of the UAA Justice Center and a professor of justice here. I was contacted earlier this week by the chair to provide you a brief report out on a much more detailed study that I conducted and published in 2016, focused on Alaska sex offender recidivism, as well as case processing. I'll have a link for you on the last slide of the deck here if you want to access that full report. And I believe it's in your packet as well, or at least it's in basis for you to access. So I'm going to be giving you sort of some brief highlights in with respect to sex offender recidivism. There is much more in the report, and I would encourage folks to read that. And if you have follow-up questions, I'd be happy to entertain those as well. So we'll go ahead and proceed on to slide 2, please. So the quick overview or my plan of attack for you today is quite brief. Talk about the study, what we hope to achieve when we conducted it, the data and methods that were used. And then I'm going to provide you with three views, three perspectives or empirical perspectives on Alaska sex offender recidivism. And then we can just open it up for a Q&A based on information that's provided in the presentation or other questions that you might have. So we can go to slide 3, please. So a little bit about the study. It was pretty straightforward. We had two goals: to update and expand the knowledge about sex offender recidivism in Alaska when the study was done. I want to be clear here. Certainly there had been a good amount of research that had been conducted in the state of Alaska on sex offender recidivism, particularly by the Alaska Judicial Council. But it wasn't real current at the time. There were lots of policy discussions being had, and so we undertook this study with funding support from the U.S. Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, to take a deep dive. We accomplished these goals with three specific objectives. The first was to provide specific estimates of Alaska sex offender recidivism. The second, and it's related to the first, was to expand the post-incarceration follow-up period. So very often, as I'm sure members of this committee are aware, our recidivism picture tends to be pretty narrow, and we look at 2 or 3 years following release. And I wanted to take a look at recidivism and get more towards the medium or long term, so we understand not only recidivism or reoffending, but also to begin taking a look at what we refer to in criminology as desistance, patterns of declining rates of criminal participation by folks who are following their release from prison. And then third, and I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail on the relevant slide, is I used some techniques called group-based trajectory modeling to examine potential differences in recidivism, sex offender recidivism, to understand or to answer the question, is there heterogeneity in the patterns of reoffending upon release? So in most discussions of recidivism, we assume all recidivists are the same because we just measure them one way. Did they reoffend or did they not reoffend? We don't ask deeper questions about given reoffense. Do particular groups of recidivists reoffend at higher or lower rates compared to others? And so I'll tackle that question with the last graphical slide in the deck.
And I'll just take a very short brief to note that Representative Kirka joined us at 2:35. Please proceed.
Thank you. So if we can proceed to slide 4, just a quick overview of the data. Two of our longstanding partnerships here at the UA Justice Center, our partners at the Alaska Department of Corrections, provided the data that allowed us to identify the sample of sex offenders. And just some quick detail on the composition of that sample. There were four, in the final analysis sample, there were 406 individuals, unique individuals. Those individuals had to be convicted of one or more qualifying sex offenses to be included in the sample. And for the purposes of this study, they were registrable sex offenses. So not just sexual assault, but all registrable sex offenses. They had to have been sentenced to a period of incarceration in an ADOC facility or contract facility. And they had to have been released from incarceration between January 1st, 2006 and December 31st, 2008. So we have a 3-year time catchment period for people who were released following conviction for a qualifying sex offense. The second data source came from our partners at the Alaska Department of Public Safety, and they provided detailed criminal history data, full criminal history data, on all 406 members of the sample. I shouldn't say the sample, it's a population. We didn't sample from, we took everybody who was released who met those inclusion criteria. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with criminal history repository data and how they're used in recidivism analysis, they provide two important measures. One is arrest and the other is conviction information. And so those are the two outcome measures that we're particularly focused on in this recidivism analysis, rearrest as well as conviction for a new offense. And I will pause here to see if there are any questions about the data sources that were used.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Dr. Mearsall. I was reading ahead, and forgive me, I want to make sure I heard you correctly. In the sample of offenders, did I hear you say that was all offenders and actually not a sample, or this was a true sample?
No, that's correct. It's actually a population. So I should not have used the term sample in the slide. It's actually everyone released who met those inclusion criteria.
Great. Thank you for that.
I don't see any other questions. Keep rolling.
Okay, we'll go ahead and skip forward to slide 6. And what I will do, because I know I'm used to looking at these graphs and you may not be, is try to orient you to the data that are depicted. So this is view 1 of sex offender recidivism. And I'll just start with the horizontal or the x-axis. And what is depicted on the horizontal axis, the one going from left to right, is time. And this is time following release from prison, beginning at day zero, going all the way out to 7 years. On the y-axis or the vertical axis, we have the cumulative percentage of sex offenders convicted of a qualifying sex offense who were released from an Alaska prison who recidivated at each point of time. I want to point out that this is a cumulative graph, and so it's always additive. And this is important to understand because it will always go up. It might go flat, but it will never decrease, because once a person is counted as a recidivist using this measure of recidivism, they're always in that pool. So, for example, if somebody recidivates, commits a new crime, and is rearrested 6 months following release, they're in that count all the way to the conclusion of that time series. So that's sort of the general frame. Now let me explain the data that are actually depicted in the graph. Starting at the top, we have the solid bold line depicts the proportion or percentage of sex offenders released from prison who were rearrested for any offense at each point in time. It culminates at 7 years in 55.4% of sex offenders who were rearrested for one or more offense, any offense. I'll just pause here to note that I think we can easily see the value of extending the time period in the follow-up, because if we were looking at 3 years, it would be 40.4%. But by expanding out to 7 years, we see that it's 55.4 at the end of that time period. The second line, the long dash, represents the proportion of sex offenders released from prison who were convicted of one or more new offenses, any offense, at each point in time. You'll notice that this is less than rearrest, because conviction is a lagged indicator on arrest. So somebody is arrested and it takes time for that case to reach resolution. So this is always going to be a lagged indicator relative to arrest.
I think Representative Snyder has a question.
And I apologize. It appears Dr. Mistos is still working his way through the graph. I'm happy to wait until you're...
Oh, go ahead and finish this page, and then we'll take up the question when you finish the graph.
Sure. Thank you. The third and final line depicting sex offender recidivism is the small dash line down near the x-axis. And that depicts the proportion of sex offenders released from prison who were rearrested for a qualifying sex offense. So this gets at sex offenders committing new sex crimes. We do not depict in this graph the proportion of sex offenders who were reconvicted for new sex crimes, because those proportions were so small, they couldn't be depicted. They basically, for visual purposes, sit right on the x-axis, very near zero. And I will pause there, Chair Klayman, for the question from Representative Snyder.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So in looking at a fairly flat, not entirely flat, of course, but a fairly flat line associated with rearrest for sex offense, yet perhaps a disappointingly steep line for rearrest for any offense. It might suggest that we're doing something right to slow the cumulative rate of rearrest for sex offense, but it's not addressing other types of offenses. Do you have any insight into why we see that?
I think that that question might be addressed in the next slide, but I will tackle it a little bit here as perhaps as a strategy for preview. I don't have a specific page number, a set of page numbers for the committee. I would strongly recommend we detail what people were arrested for. And I think the overall analytic point, rather than losing sight of the forest for the trees, is that sex offenders, like other offenders, are not specialists, and that they engage in a wide variety of criminal conduct that comes to the attention of authorities. And so they are not unique in that regard. And when you look at the pattern of rearrest, it's everything from motor vehicle offenses to public order crimes to other violent crimes, felony property crimes, the whole gamut. And so what I would highlight here for Representative Snyder is, and why I've depicted the rearrest for sex offense, is I think oftentimes in conversations about recidivism, the assumption is when you say a certain class of people recidivate at a certain rate, the assumption is they redid the thing for which they were incarcerated. So a big part of the story is recidivism is rarely, and I think this is reflected in this graph, for the same thing for which a person was incarcerated in their most immediate or most recent conviction. In terms of the difference in the slopes of the line, if I may, Mr. Chair, elaborate on that a little bit, please. If that's okay.
Please.
Okay. So I'm going to try to not get too technical and nerdy about this, but I will highlight that Representative Snyder is very correct. And if you look at the slope of the curve for rearrest for sex offense, it's very linear. It's almost a perfect straight line. The same is not true for the pattern of rearrest for any offense. The slope of that line changes rather dramatically. And so you have a parabolic curve. In the early days, in the immediate re-release period, the slope of that line is quite steep. And then it begins to flatten out as you approach the end of the time series at year 7. So certainly within the first year following release from prison is the biggest at-risk period for observing recidivism, any offense recidivism, for this group of offenders. Then it gets a little bit better, and over time, the relative risk of recidivism declines as that line begins to flatten out. And you can see this if you just look at the numbers that are depicted above the line. So if we look at the rearrest, the bold line, the top line, at 6 months, 16.3% of sex offenders have been rearrested for one or more new offense, any offense. First 6 months, 16% jump, right, from 0 to 16.3. And then by the first year, 1 in 4 have been rearrested for one or more offense, any offense. So 1 in 4 have been rearrested at least once within the first year. But then you go out to 2 years and you have a 9% increase in the next year. So the first year, you get all the way to 25. In the second year, the rate of increase dramatically declines. And then it's 7% to the next year, 5% to the next year, 4% to the next year, about 3% to the next year, and so on and so forth. So I appreciate the attention to detail of the question, because what we see is change in recidivism risk over time. And there are certain periods where recidivism is more likely to occur than others.
So I just go ahead, Representative Snyder, with a question. I just note that we're starting to come up on 3 o'clock, and I know we've got a couple more slides, and a lot of the information on page 12 and to 13 of the 26th report, which was distributed to the committee, there's a parsing out of the arrest offenses and convictions and the different
That's crimes. Great. I'm happy to wait, and I know where to find Dr. Nerstall. Thank you.
Okay. So if you want to go, if you're ready, if you can go to the next slide.
Okay. We'll jump to slide 7. This is view 2 on recidivism to help put in context what we see with Alaska sex offenders. So at the very bottom of this slide, you'll see the rearrest recidivism for Alaska sex offenders that culminates in 55.4% by year 7. Depicted above that are data from the U.S. Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Statistics from a study that was conducted when my report was initially published for 30 states, one of which, by the way, includes Alaska, for the recidivism rates for different classes of offenders. So the small dash line depicts the out to five-year recidivism rate for people who were convicted of a property offense. That was their most serious conviction offense, was a property crime of some sort. Their five-year recidivism rate topped out at 82.1%, 33.6% in the first year. So again, this is from 30 states aggregated data. Drug offenses come in next in the graph, the longer dashed line. And then a catch-all category for violent offenses, which for the BJS data include all violent crimes, including homicide, as well as rape and sexual assault and others. And so this help us understand in general in some context of the likelihood of recidivism for different classes of offenders, if you will. And what we clearly see here is that the risk of recidivism for sex offenders is substantially lower than for people who are convicted of other offenses, at least out to 5 years. But I would expect those differences in those recidivism curves to be maintained over the long term. Just a quick side note, this is not included in the slide deck, but there's an Alaska Justice Forum issue I'll be happy to send to Lizzie from our results first work here at the Alaska Justice Information Center, where we examined the recidivism of various crimes to provide cost-benefit analyses on various recidivism reduction programs. And in that analysis, which was conducted by my colleague, Dr. Araceli Valley, we find that sex offenders, the rate of recidivism for Alaska sex offenders is also less than people who get misdemeanor, are convicted of misdemeanor DUI, felony DUI, and domestic violence. So again, whether we're looking at sort of national context or state context, the data depicted in the graphs that I've shown you so far make clear this point, that the likelihood of recidivism following release for prison of convicted sex offenders is not necessarily low. I want to be clear, I'm not saying that, but it is significantly lower than other offenders. Next slide, please.
Before we pick up the next slide, Representative East.
Thank you, through the chair. Just curious, on slide 7, how do you respond when someone says, you know, of course your sex offender, you know, recidivism is lower because you're dealing with crimes that have stiffer penalties, it's harder to get prosecutions and convictions, you know, you've got property and drug and violence, you know, maybe on the violent side that would be similar, but certainly compared to property crimes, it's going to be a lot easier to get a conviction on a property crime, which is, you know, would explain why you've got that lower trend line for sex offenders.
Thank you for the question, Representative Eastman. Through the chair, the first point of clarification, what I've depicted here sort of in when I was drafting the report in anticipation of that particular question is these are rearrest data, not conviction data. So the which there still may be differences in investigatory practices and the ability of the system to come into view of particular offenses. This would be the earliest point in the criminal legal process, right? So a lot of that other filtering and complex case complexity factors become slightly moot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I guess it's to the next slide, I think.
Okay. So this one, I'm going to do my best. I want to be mindful of time. I see we're at 2:54. This gets to the third objective of the study, and this was much more sophisticated analytics, and I will not go into the weeds on that, other than to say what I want to highlight what it is that we're trying to do in undertaking these analyses. So a central question for me that I think is really important for policy and practice is whether or not it is appropriate to think of sex offenders as a monolith, or that is that they're a homogeneous group with no meaningful differences, or is there heterogeneity or diversity in the pattern of reoffending among this particular group? And I'll just cut to the quick here. My analyses show that there is, in fact, diversity. I was able to identify retrospectively, looking back on their reoffending behavior, four distinctive groups. Group one is depicted as the sort of bold dash line, second from the bottom in the graph. 24% of sex offender recidivists fell into that group. Group two, which is the very narrow line, close to the x-axis, was more than half of the 228 folks who had recidivated by year seven. Group three, which is the dot dash line, represented 15.3%. And then we have group four, which was a small proportion of the overall recidivist population, but which I want to highlight here for the committee, the rate of offending that distinguished that group from the other three. So what we have here is, first of all, again, heterogeneity, diversity in offending patterns, the intensity and frequency of rearrest. But what we see is an accelerating rate of reoffending for group four through almost year five post-release. I suppose the good news is that curve began to turn, that as year seven approached, that rate of recidivism began to decline, but was still magnitudes higher than the other three groups. I want to highlight here this notion of dynamism or dynamic process, because we see a curved line. There was change over time in that group. So our first finding is, wow, there's this group, small group of people doing lots of stuff following release. But the other part is they didn't just do a lot of stuff at a high level consistently, right? It accelerated through the fifth year and then declined. And then the final point would be the relative stability in offending intensity and frequency for the other three groups. And with respect to groups three and four, I just want to provide the committee with one more little bit of data that I think provides the context. So group four, which is the group at the top, 6.7% of all the recidivists, the sex offender recidivists, committed 17% of all the new arrests for all of the recidivists. 7% of the population, 17% of all the new arrests. And here, I think, is an important piece. They were only available to offend 15% of the total time in 7 years because they were incarcerated a lot or reincarcerated a lot. So they are only available to offend 15% of 7 years. Still, they committed 17% of all the rearrests, even though they comprised only 7% of the reoffender population. So I for me, this was a bit of a revelation. I must admit that it was my initial hypothesis going in, because it is a stubborn criminological fact that within the population of offenders, no matter how we slice it, how we dice it, there tends to be one group, small group, who commit an extraordinarily disproportionate amount of crime. And sex offenders, or convicted sex offenders subsequently released, are not unique in that regard. But prior to this work, I had not seen any published work that talked about recidivism in this way, that took the time to identify diversity or heterogeneity in the pattern of reoffending.
So one quick question for clarity, and then I see Representative Price Tompkins, and then we'll run a little bit late, but not much. Representative, can you just say who's group one, who's group two, who's group three, and who's group four in the graph?
Mr. Chair, when you say who, can you specify what you mean?
Well, I mean, you've got group one that has a 24%, group two with a 54%. What is the population in that group?
Thank you for the question. I want to be clear here in terms of the research. We take great pains to not be able to identify individuals. So to the extent that I can describe for you the composition of this group, it's going to be in generalities. There is a section in the report, and I'm going to try to give you a page number here, that provides some description of the composition of these groups. So, for example, table 1.7 on page 21 of the report describes the demographic characteristics of the folks who are in each of the respective groups. Table 1.8 speaks to the criminal history, that is the pattern of criminal offending prior to the conviction for their qualifying offense for inclusion in this study, of those. So just as a quick example to help you navigate these tables, on table 1.8, the first line there lists the average number of prior arrests for any offense. So these would be arrests prior to the arrest that put them in prison that included them in this study. Group four had 15.8 on average prior arrests. Group two, just by way of comparison, had 8.7 arrests.
I think the short answer is we should look, it's in pages around page 20, 21, 22, and 23 of the report. We should look to there to get an understanding of the groups.
Yes.
I just know we've got some time limitations. Representative Price Tompkins, question, and we'll everybody else get one more question, and then we'll wind up.
Yeah, just a comment. I mean, first, if this kind of research hasn't been published before until this report came out, I mean, that seems quite notable to me, and also just really reminds me of, I think, what they call the Pareto ratio and encounter it in all sorts of places, that sort of 80% of things can be attributable to a 20% minority. I mean, it's generalized, but like healthcare costs, like 80% of healthcare costs, the 20% of people who drive those costs. And seems like, unsurprisingly, that exists in criminological data as well.
Representative Easton, one last question.
Thank you. You know, my question is going to be one of application. So maybe there's a short answer to this question. If there is, I'd please like to invite you to give it. But since in this study, you're able to differentiate between higher recidivism and lower recidivism tranches within this demographic. Can that be reflected by legislators in statute such that the stiffer penalties can be targeted to the higher risk of reoffending group? Or does the data not permit us to do that?
Thank you for the question, Representative Eastman. Not being a criminal attorney, but only a mere criminologist, I don't think I can really speak to that. I think generally criminal sanctions have to do with the conduct for which a person is convicted, not necessarily their likelihood of reoffense. In terms of your, to get to the fine point of it, your question about the potential for dealing with this sort of data, like is presented in view three, is, you know, I think my hope as a researcher is that this would inform more practice than larger policy in terms of criminal, substantive and procedural criminal law. But, you know, for the Department of Corrections to consider, and I would defer to them. I'm sure they are well aware of different recidivism risks based on the risk assessment tools and frameworks that they use. But, and so for me, you know, I suppose for many professionals who are direct service providers or people who supervise sex offenders in the community, this is more confirmatory than revelatory. But I think my aim is to get policymakers in general aware of the features of recidivism that I think are important to contemplate. I don't know, I wouldn't have any specific recommendation in terms of a change of law, but the fact that not all recidivists are the same, right? That if we just measure them as not a recidivist or a recidivist, we're missing out on a lot that has direct public safety implications. And so if, for example, a supervision regime is undertaken for group two, which was the majority of these folks, that's the same supervision regime for group four, that begs the question, because group two reoffended at a much lower rate, a steady rate over time, whereas group four was a smaller group, accelerating rate of recidivism, and a large number of offenses committed. I'm not sure if that really got at your question, and I do apologize if I missed the mark.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Representative Kirk, I'll give you a chance for one question if you have it. Otherwise, I'll wind up. No, no questions. Okay. Well, I want to thank Dr. Merstel. Thank you for joining us today. I appreciate the report and the insights that you've provided. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, April 29th at 1 p.m. And if you're considering an amendment to Senate Bill 161, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Monday, May 2nd. Actually, all right. So I'll modify that slightly for Senate Bill 161. Amendments will be due on Tuesday, May 3rd at 5 p.m. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. The time is 3:07.